Ladies and gentlemen, this afternoon I wanted to talk about the human situation in the future. And before beginning on any series of forecasts about the future, I think it's worthwhile saying a few words about man's conception of the future. Most of us, I don't think, realize the fact that our view of the future is a fairly recent phenomenon, our kind of view, and that in the past, the way the future was looked at by people within our tradition and even outside our tradition was very different from the way in which we look at it now. We have given up completely the ancient view of time. We've given up the cyclical idea, which was the idea of the Greeks, the idea of the Indians, the notion that there is an eternal recurrence, that the things, time, so to speak, goes round and round and repeats the same pattern over and over again. According to the Indian idea, we are now at the last phase of one of the great cycles. We are in the Kali Yuga, the age of iron. We've been in it about 2,000 years, and apparently there are about 35,000 years more to go, when it will get worse and worse all the time. We ain't seen nothing yet, according to the Indians. And after that, after there will be a sort of general explosion, and we may then, after several million years, start again on an age of gold. A similar view essentially was taken by the Greeks of time. There was this great year which repeated itself continuously. When in the Christian tradition, there was of course the idea of a definite creation in time, and according to Bishop Usher, 4004 BC, a definite ending which would take place probably very soon, and a complete lack of interest in the future. Professor Bury, who has written perhaps the most interesting book on the subject in his classical work on the history of the idea of progress, as he sums up the Christian idea, he says, according to the Christian theory, which was worked out by the Church Fathers and especially by St. Augustine, the whole movement of history has the purpose of assuring the happiness of a small portion of the human race in another world. It does not postulate a further development of human history on Earth. Well, our present view, of course, is entirely different from this. We think of time not as going round and round, but as moving irreversibly in one direction. The whole idea, of course, is expressed in the scientific notion of increasing entropy. We are continually moving in this direction, and that life is a sort of temporary reversal of entropy within the larger system, which moves inexorably forward in this one way. And the whole notion of an eternal recurrence, which as late as Nietzsche was preached by some philosophers, has really gone out of the picture altogether. And we consequently think of the future in quite a different way from what people did in the past. And of course, in relation to the immediate Christian tradition of earlier centuries, we again have changed very much. One can say that in the past, the notion of the future, insofar as it was a happier and progressive future, was a notion of what is vulgarly called pie in the sky. But this was changed profoundly during the 18th and 19th century to a conception of what may be called pie on the earth. The whole idea of progress, of an advance through indefinite periods of time, an advance which some thinkers regarded as absolutely inevitable, that things had to get better and better, and which some people regarded as conditional. But this whole idea of of an improving world is a new idea. First of all, the idea of an indefinite amount of future time is new, and then the idea of a time which may show very great improvements over the present is a very new idea. It replaces the ancient idea of an age of gold in the past and a gradual and either a sudden fall, as within the Christian tradition, or a gradual deterioration, as within the Oriental traditions. This has been replaced by the idea of a progress which goes forward and may be expected to reach a pitch of perfection in distant time. And just as in the past, the old conception of pie in the sky justified both resignation to an intolerable lot upon earth and also justified persecution, in exactly the same way, this idea of pie in the sky has both fostered resignation and persecution. Under the old dispensation, it was right, in St. Augustine's delicious phrase, to use what he called benignant asperity towards heretics in order to safeguard their eternal bliss in the next world. I mean, that to destroy them in this world was as nothing compared to the benefits you were doing them by saving them in eternal life. And in the same way, we see in the modern world the most appalling persecutions and liquidations going on in the name not of heaven, but in the name of the extraordinarily good time which our great-grandchildren will have in the 22nd century. The idea is that if we liquidate enough people now, then there will be this magnificent time 200 years from now, which will go on forever, getting better and better. In the same way, the resignation which in the past was obtained by people who compensated themselves for the miseries of life in this world by reflections about the life in the world to come, this resignation, again, I think, has been felt in the previous century and up till the present time, by people who reflect about the much better times which are coming in the future upon earth. It's interesting to go back to the literary expressions of these ideas. Needless to say, the compensatory idea of a better life in heaven has played an enormous part in the religious and social life of the world. Historians are agreed, for example, that the Wesley and the Wesleyan movement in the 18th century was instrumental in guaranteeing England against a violent revolution, that the intolerable conditions created in the first generations of the Industrial Revolution were made tolerable to the laboring masses who were living in conditions of indescribable wretchedness by this ardent preaching of the happiness which was going to take place after death. And in the same way, there seems to have been a real feeling during the 19th century among the oppressed and the miserable that this wonderful good time which was going to come two or three centuries from now was in some way a compensation for the miseries being suffered at the present. And we have, as I say, some very interesting literary expressions of this idea. One of the first 19th century expressions of it is to be found in Tennyson's poem, Locksley Hall, which was published in 1842. And this is a very curious poem. It's the hero of the poem is a young man who has been bitterly disappointed in love. and who consoles himself not by philosophy and not by religion, but by reflecting on the march of progress and on the wonderful time which will happen in the future. He talks about the increase of knowledge, the increase of virtue, and finally the expansion of the world into the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World. And a few years later, in the same year as the publication of The Origin of Species in 1859, you find Victor Hugo in France even more lyrically talking about progress and what it means to man. He has the most fantastic passage where he speaks of man sailing in a kind of magic ship through the ether. And I've literally translated the passage, which is really very peculiar. To start with, he says that the ship is the calculus of Newton mounted upon the odes of Pindar, so that one has a notion of what he was conceiving of a mixture of inspiration and science. And he speaks of that man is sailing, clothed in light, into the pure and divine future, into virtue, into shining knowledge, into the end of plague and disaster, into abundance, into calm and laughter and happiness, into union with heaven. And this goes on for hundreds of lines. This clearly was Victor Hugo's brand of religion. And it's interesting to find that there perhaps a majority of the great literary figures of the 19th century felt rather in the same way. There are a few exceptions. You'll find in Alfred de Vigny, for example, an extremely skeptical reaction to the first railroads. He was by no means convinced, as Victor Hugo was convinced, or as Michelet, the French historian, was convinced, that railroads were going to transport the human race into universal peace and universal virtue. On the contrary, he spoke of the potential dangers which this new machinery might bring upon man, the dangers that the machinery might actually enslave its creator. And it's interesting to see this dark picture appearing just at the time when there was the most unbounded optimism in regard to technical progress. And in the outside the world of literature, you find these same ideas very strongly expressed at the time of the Great Exhibition of 1851 in London, the first of the Universal Exhibitions. This was opened by the Prince Consort on May the 1st, 1851. And he spoke of it as the realization of the unity of mankind. And in the staid columns of the London Times, there were equally enthusiastic editorials which spoke about the exhibition as foreshadowing universal peace, and saying that this May the 1st is the first morning since the creation that all the peoples have assembled from all parts of the world to perform a common act. And this tremendous enthusiasm did infect almost everybody. And it's interesting to find that it was regarded at the time, this new religion of progress, this religion of the future upon earth, it was, as I say, at the time regarded by the guardians of Christian orthodoxy as extremely dangerous and heretical. In the Syllabus of Errors, published by Pius IX in 1864, he lists as one of the grave errors which must be pointed out and condemned, the error that the Roman pontiff should come to terms with and reconcile himself to with progress liberalism and modern civilization. This was definitely a heresy which must not be accepted. And we see that there was clearly recognized this incompatibility between the new view of time and of human development on earth and the old traditional Augustinian view of time on earth being quite unimportant and the possibility of future development and betterment existing only for a few in another world. Well, then, in 1859, of course, we come to the crucial year of the publication of The Origin of Species and the new conception of the world as an evolutionary world which had gone on from immense distances in the past without any breach of continuity at all between the lower forms and the highest human forms, and that would go on indefinitely into the future. Now, of course, the evolutionary theory as such is neither optimistic nor pessimistic, but it can be interpreted in either way. There has, I think one can say quite definitely, that there have been progressive movements within evolution. It's absurd to say that a human being is not superior to an amoeba. He clearly is superior. There has been a progress along this particular line. At the same time, it is again quite clear that the evolutionary process has not been progressive along all the lines, that many lines have become extinct and many lines have become completely stagnant, so that the world is full today of what may be called living fossils. But there has been quite clearly a line of progress within the line of evolution. But in general, it can be said that the theory of evolution, when applied to human beings, neither justifies neither pessimism nor optimism. However, in fact, the prevailing interpretation in the latter half of the 19th century was an optimistic interpretation. There were pessimists such as Eduard von Hartmann, but he was much less influential than, for example, Herbert Spencer, who developed a most elaborate theory of evolutionary philosophy, which was essentially optimistic. He did believe in the inevitability of progress, of human progress, that this couldn't help happening. And unfortunately, his whole theory assumed as its basis the inheritance of acquired characteristics, which we now reject and which we have every reason for believing to be untrue. But there is no question that Herbert Spencer did exercise a prodigious influence in the second half of the 19th century, and that there was an extremely optimistic view of the future, that progress was happening all the time and would almost certainly go on happening. And I remember as a child, the golden glow of this optimistic theory, the notion that we who were fortunate enough to live in the more civilized parts of the world were really incapable of doing the sort of things that people had done in the remote past, or that people were doing in the uncivilized parts of the world. I mean, it was possible only for Turks, for example, to slaughter Armenians on a large scale, but that people who wore top hats and went to church on Sundays and took a bath every morning couldn't, in the nature of things, do such things. Well, of course, then came the appalling shock of the Second World War and the realization that the most dreadful atrocities and moral insensibilities were possible even in highly developed people. And indeed, it is very extraordinary as I look back on the past. When I think, for example, if somebody had asked me as a child or my parents if they thought that within my lifetime I should see a large-scale revival of slavery, of torture, of persecution for heretical opinions, of mass deportations. If anybody had asked this, everybody would have said, well, of course, it's absolutely impossible. And nevertheless, we have seen these dreadful things. And we have seen, I think, on one side of the ledger, a great blunting of moral sensibility in regard to these atrocities. So that, in general, I think our hope in regard to the inevitability of progress has been very much shaken. We are convinced, of course, that we live in a world of change, of incessant change. But we are not at all convinced now that this change must necessarily, in the nature of things, be a favorable change, a change in a direction which our system of values would regard as excellent. This, which seemed almost self-evident to Herbert Spencer, I mean, he regarded this as a law of equal validity with the Newton's law of gravitation. This seems to us completely untenable now, and that we have our tempered optimism is that if we use enough intelligence and goodwill, we probably can achieve a high degree of progress, but that it is up to us to see that this happens, and there is nothing in the processes of change themselves which are going to compel it to happen. And this, as I say, is our view now, I think, of the future, is the most common view. And an interesting fact is, too, is that with the coming of the hydrogen bomb, we have seen reintroduced into the thinking of the West the old eschatological idea of the end of the world, that this has become now a possibility, that what is talked about in the apocalyptic literature, the sudden and catastrophic ending of the world, has, as far as we are concerned, become once more a real possibility. And that, again, there is a real possibility that for us, at any rate, there is not an indefinite future. Again, this is up to us whether there shall be an indefinite future or whether there shall not. And it is a very interesting thing to see how human technology has reintroduced into our thinking this ancient notion which we had come to regard as untenable and absurd, but which is now, unfortunately, a genuine possibility. And now let us consider, from our present viewpoint, what is likely to happen in the future. We'll begin with a very long-range view. This was taken about 4 or 5 years ago in an interesting little book by Sir Charles Darwin, the grandson of the naturalist, who is himself a physicist, in a book called The Next Million Years. It would seem, of course, at first glance, that it's quite impossible to foresee what is likely to happen within a million years. And yet, in a certain paradoxical way, it is easier to make prophecies about very large spans of time than to make prophecies about shorter spans of time. The reason, of course, is quite obvious. We are dealing in great spans of time with huge numbers, and the average behavior of great numbers of things or persons or events is more foreseeable than the behavior of small numbers or of individual events. I mean, we see this everywhere around us. No fortune teller of our acquaintance has ever made a fortune by telling fortunes. But no insurance company has ever gone bankrupt. The reason being that the insurance company foretells the future for millions and therefore can always be sure of making a profit, whereas the fortune teller tells fortunes only for one person and is likely to be much more often wrong than right. The same is true, I think, in regard to forecasts over great distances of time. Huge numbers are involved, and it seems the ups and downs tend to level themselves out, to cancel out over the great periods, and a general sort of line may perhaps be projected into the future. Sir Charles Darwin's view is simply this, that that man is a wild species. He has not been domesticated. A domestic animal is an animal which has a master, which teaches it tricks, and which controls its breeding, either by sterilizing it or crossing it with certain definite types, and therefore making sure that future generations shall follow a particular pattern which he wishes it to have. But man has no master, and even his attempts at self-domestication are in a certain sense always doomed to frustration, inasmuch as the ruling minority which does the domestication itself remains a wild species. There is nothing which domesticates it. For this reason, in Sir Charles Darwin's opinion, man will never transcend the limitations imposed upon a wild species. His view is that, like all other wild species, whatever may happen for short periods of history, in the long run, the human species will always do what every other wild species has done, which will live up to the very limits of its food supply, with a large margin in a state of semi-starvation all the time, and that this will go on with ups and downs, golden ages and iron ages, but all ironed out over these 10,000 centuries which he's envisaging, until after a million years we may expect the species either to be extinct or to have evolved into quite a different species. It is rather a gloomy point of view, but I don't think entirely justified. I don't think Sir Charles Darwin gives credit to the human race for the extraordinary amount of ingenuity it has and its ability to get out of extremely tight corners which it gets itself into. And I think too that he perhaps hasn't given credit to the human race for its extraordinary toughness, that it is probably the toughest species of all animals. It can exist in every conceivable kind of environment, and in spite of everything can stand the most appalling strains and stresses, apparently better than almost any other species. And therefore, it may be that this great long-range view, which has certain philosophical justifications, may, owing to the extraordinary capacity of men to spring surprises, may prove to be wrong. Meanwhile, we have to consider the short range, which is more interesting to us. What are the short range prospects in front of us? Let us begin with the military and political prospects immediately confronting us. These were discussed a few years ago by Bertrand Russell, it seems to me that his conclusions in regard to these military and political prospects of the near future are extremely realistic and sensible. He says there are three possibilities confronting us. First of all, if we get into a nuclear war, there is the possibility of the complete extinction of the species, and perhaps if the nuclear war is sufficiently prolonged and waged with sufficiently deadly weapons, perhaps the extinction of all life upon Earth. This is, I think, improbable, certainly in the present state of technology. The next possibility is that the nuclear war would result in a return to barbarism. Now, under present circumstances, this second alternative seems to have a good deal of probability. It could easily occur, really, for this reason, that a complex industrial system, such as we depend upon now, has very close analogies to an ecological system in nature. In nature, if we disturb one element in an ecological system, we throw the entire system out of gear. And analogously, if we were to destroy pretty thoroughly even one or a few elements in the complex industrial system, and if there was to be, for any reason, a high mortality of the specially trained personnel on whom we depend for the functioning of the system, then it seems extremely probable that the whole system would break down, that it would be virtually impossible to run the system without one particular part of it. So that it seems quite possible that even a relatively small degree of destruction, it would be much greater than the degree of destruction caused during the last war, but it wouldn't have to be anything like total destruction. Such partial destruction might very well produce a complete breakdown of the industrial system, and would, I think, result probably in a return of barbarism. What we must remember is that the present enormous populations of the world are unable to live solely in virtue of possessing this very complicated industrial and communication system, and that if this system were to break down, enormous numbers of people would probably die of starvation and would naturally indulge in civil wars in order to get at the few resources remaining. So that it seems quite possible that the consequences of a nuclear war would be, first of all, naturally a very great number of deaths immediately following the explosion of the H-bombs, followed by an even greater number of deaths and an immense chaos due to the breakdown of the industrial system on which modern civilization depends. And another thing is that it would be, in contemporary circumstances, exceedingly difficult to rebuild the system, for this reason, that when the system was originally built with rather primitive machinery and tools, when it was started, the resources available were very plentiful and in very rich supply. For example, the metallic ores were extremely rich and quite easy to get at. Today, after 150 years of exploitation, this is not at all true. It would be very difficult for any people which had been reduced to a primitive level to rebuild a complex civilization on the basis of the rather impoverished resources left particularly in those countries which have been highly developed up till now. You would have the paradox that it would be easier to rebuild an industrial civilization in those parts of the world which had not been previously industrialized, and more difficult to rebuild it in those parts of the world which had been previously industrialized and which had greatly reduced the content of their ores and so on. One can say that after a serious atomic war, that mankind would start not from scratch, but with a very severe handicap. It would start several hundred yards behind scratch, and that this would make, as I say, the rebuilding of a system comparable to ours exceedingly difficult, and indeed possibly out of the question, all the more so as the breakdown would have caused a period of chaos and disturbance. So that, as I say, the possibility of the coming of a new age of barbarism seems to be a possibility which is actually a probability if there should be a very severe nuclear war. The third alternative, which Lord Russell looks forward to, is the creation of a single world state. Well, this could be created in one of two ways, either by force as the result of a victorious, of one power being victorious in a nuclear war, that is to say, if one power could ever be victorious. This, in fact, is the way that previous empires have always been built up by military force. Or it could occur under the threat, perhaps, of force, under the fear of what might happen, as a result of reason and considered enlightened self-interest and humane ideals. This naturally would be the desirable way of creating what Wendell Willkie called one world. We have briefly to think about the probability of the creation of a single world government on a voluntary basis. And it must be confessed that the historical precedents are not very encouraging. For example, take the case of single countries such as Italy. From the time of Dante onwards, at least, every intelligent Italian saw that it was absolutely essential to have a united Italy. But Italy was not, in fact, united until 1870, and then it was united only by military force, by the Piedmontese coming in. And to this day, you can meet Italians in southern Italy or Sicilians who will speak rather bitterly of the time when the Piedmontese descended upon Italy and forcibly drew them together into a single country. And the same thing, of course, is true of Germany. The final uniting of Germany came after the Franco-Prussian War and was essentially an act of force. And one sees the same thing in the building up of a unified France. The use of force and cunning by Richelieu in the 17th century was necessary for creating the single unified nation. And we are therefore confronted with a very grave problem. Can we expect the coming together of the nations into a single world government, which is obviously infinitely desirable? Can we expect it to happen by democratic means? And this can be expressed in more general terms by saying, can one expect a course of action which is manifestly good for everybody in the long run, but which in the short run causes discomfort or even suffering to a good many people, can we expect such a course of action to be voted in by a democratic society in time of peace? Can one expect people to vote for short-range discomfort or even suffering for the purpose of achieving a long-range good? I don't know. I think it seems to me rather dubious that this should be the case, because there are enormous vested interests involved. It is not merely the vested interest of the rulers, which is very great. The rulers of a sovereign state do not wish to become merely officials in a province. Similarly, the owners of factories do not want to subordinate the interests which flourish under a tariff system, do not want to subordinate it to the interests of a much larger unit where outside the present borders of the country there will be more efficient factories which will completely throw their own factory out of business. In the same way, there are vested interests of many workers who might be displaced from their work, thrown out of employment and caused to migrate to other parts of the country, who don't want this sort of thing. And there are also the vested interests of intellectuals who don't wish to change their ideas, and indeed the vested interests of everybody who don't want to alter the conditioning which they had in childhood. So that we see there are very great difficulties in expecting the necessary and desirable unification of the world to take place by peaceful and democratic means. In general, one can say it is only when men are threatened by somebody else, it is only against somebody else, that human beings are ready to unite. They are ready, of course, in wartime to accept short-range privations for long-range goods, and they are ready to unite under the threat of war, the threat of catastrophe. And, of course, undoubtedly the best thing for one world, for a world government under law, would be an invasion from Mars. Unfortunately, this is, I think, rather unlikely to take place. But is it possible to persuade ourselves that, after all, human beings are their own Martians, that what with overpopulation and over-organization and over-technicization, we are committing immense aggressions against ourselves? And can we unite against ourselves for our own higher interest? Possibly I could conceive that it might be possible to, by a suitable education and propaganda, to put this view across, that we are uniting against something which, if we don't unite against it, will lead us into catastrophe, and that what we regard as a piping time of peace is in fact not a piping time of peace, that there is a real threat overhanging us all the time, against which it is enormously to our interest to unite. This, I'm afraid, is rather a remote speculation, but it is, seems to me, just possible that some such argument might finally persuade people to take the step of getting together and forming a government in which all should live together under law. If there is, of course, a conquest, I presume, if there's a unification by conquest, I would say that should the West win, we should see a kind of very superior, up-to-date Roman Empire at the time of the Antonines. And if the East should win, if the Russians and the Chinese, I think we would see a very much more unpleasant kind of empire in which Western people would find themselves living on the wrong side of the tracks and thoroughly differentiated against. So that this, as I say, seems to be the military and the immediate military and political possibilities in front of us. Now we have briefly to consider the technical and industrial prospects. Here, the problem is, I suppose, one of resources. There are those who wish to know more about this, but I would advise them to read Harrison Brown's Challenge of Man's Future and Brown, Weir, and Bonner's book on the next 100 years, where all the figures are given, which are, I must say, very extraordinary. I mean, when one considers, for example, that the amount of planetary capital consumed by the United States since the end of the First World War is greater than the entire amount of metals, fuels, minerals consumed by the entire human race before that, one realizes what a fantastic drain upon resources is now going on, that in order to carry on our present civilization, we require, I think it is, I have the figures here, 1,300 pounds of steel per head per annum, 23 pounds of copper, 26 pounds of lead, 3.5 tons of stone, gravel, and sand, 500 pounds of cement, 400 pounds of clay, 200 pounds of salt, 100 pounds of phosphate rock, in all about 20 tons. Then added to this, each member of the population requires the equivalent of 8 tons of coal to provide energy for him per year. So that one sees the amount which is being used in a modern technical civilization is incredibly great. And of course, one of the consequences, as I hinted before, is that the easily accessible rich ores have to a large extent been exhausted. That 50 years ago, a good copper ore contained 5% of copper. Today, ores are being worked with hardly more than half of 1% of copper. And this is certainly going to go on. We are going to have to work poorer and poorer ores, which will finally culminate in our exploiting granite and seawater to get the necessary metals and minerals that we require. And this and theoretically it can perfectly well be done, and even in practice one can see how it could be done. But it will undoubtedly require far more work than to get our raw materials than we put into it now, and will entail an immense mechanization far beyond anything that we envisage today. And then comes the question, which has often been posed, of how long will these planetary resources last? The estimates vary very greatly between a few hundred years and a few thousand years, but sooner or later it is quite clear that the richer ores will be exhausted and that we shall have to depend upon the poorer ores going down as far as seawater. And here Dr. Harrison Brown has posed the question, what likelihood is there of man being able to make the transition from an industrial life based upon rich ores to an industrial life based upon the poorest ores? It will require an incredible amount of ingenuity and skill to process these very poor ores. And will he be able to make this transition? Dr. Brown again offers three alternatives. He thinks that the more probable of the alternatives is that in course of time man will revert to an agrarian civilization. The other alternative is that he will succeed in making the transition, and that we shall then have a worldwide industrial civilization completely controlled by a totalitarian authority. The third possibility is that the transition will be made and that we shall have a worldwide free industrial society devoted to the full development of human beings. And as he says, this third alternative is obviously the most desirable, but is extremely difficult both to achieve and also to maintain. And as I say, he is inclined to think that within the next 1,000 years or so, provided we escape war, we may find ourselves gradually returning to the agrarian state. Well, now let us consider some of the immediate possibilities and prospects in front of us. We'll begin with the biological sciences, with biochemistry, where one finds such great authorities in the field as Dr. Szent Györgyi, being convinced that through his science, through the biochemistry, means will be found for controlling population and therefore for stabilizing world conditions and making some kind of reasonable development possible. He leaves out of account, of course, that the problem is not merely biochemical, but is also sociological, psychological, philosophical, and religious. But on the biochemical level, I think we can look forward to such a consummation. Then in regard to food production, there seems to be no doubt that this can be enormously increased by the development of new varieties of plants with directed mutation using gamma rays and so on to produce the mutations, by the domestication of various creation and domestication of various types of bacteria and fungi for producing different kinds of edible substances, and also I would think by new methods of finding water, such as my friend who lives in Santa Barbara here, Stephen Rees, is working on the methods of finding what has been called juvenile water, and therefore making possible the irrigation of vast areas which at present are completely barren. And it seems fairly clear that if we can stabilize the population, it should be possible to feed them at an adequate level, probably with a vegetarian diet, inasmuch as the meat diet is extremely wasteful. Then we have to consider the advances in chemistry. There will be enormous advances in chemistry. I presume one of the most important advances will spring probably from basic research in photosynthesis, which will open up the field of what may be called radiation chemistry. It will certainly be found, I think, that an enormous number of chemical processes can take place under controlled radiation, not merely by sunlight, but of course by the harder radiations possible with we have large atomic piles, and that quite unprecedented kinds of chemical synthesis will become possible. It's naturally, nobody can say exactly what will happen, but I think we can say that it certainly will happen. And this will happen, of course, entirely as a result of basic research, not as a result of ad hoc research. We still tend to be obsessed with doing research to solve a particular problem. But of course, the real basic discoveries only come as a byproduct of basic research. I read the other day in a very amusing remarks by Dr. Szent Györgyi about the nature of basic research. He says, "When I first came to this country 10 years ago, I had the greatest difficulty to find means for my basic research. People asked me, 'What you are doing, what is it good for?' I had to say, 'It is no good at all.' Then they asked, 'Then exactly what are you going to do?' I had to answer, 'I don't know. That is why it is research.' So the next question was, 'How do you expect us to waste money on you when you don't know what you do or why you do it?' The question I could not answer." Such questions are not asked anymore. All the same, there is plenty of room for improvement. Well, it is this kind of research, of course, which is going to to give us these answers, and not the kind of ad hoc research for solving a particular problem. Then, from the biological and the chemical world, let us pass to the human world, the world of biochemistry, of psychopharmacology, and so on. Here again, I think without any doubt, we are going to see extraordinary developments. We shall probably see extraordinary developments, I say precisely, in the field of psychopharmacology, the creation of a more, as a result of basic research in metabolism, the creation of a better environment for the central nervous system, and the elimination, consequently, of a great many mental disorders and psychophysical diseases. And then, of course, there may be, the kind of scientific application which the eminent geneticist Professor Hermann Muller speaks about, the application of eugenic methods to the improvement of the human stock. Muller speaks about what he calls foster parenthood, and the possibility of the creation of a new kind of morality by which people would think it more important to produce children, to bear children who were the best possible in the field of nature, rather than children who exactly reproduced their parents' idiosyncrasies and weaknesses, and that this would be possible by foster parenthood, by the union of one or both reproductive cells derived from stocks representing the parents' most highest considered ideal. Sooner or later, I think eugenics will be practiced, but it is certainly going to take a tremendous revolution in our present ethical ideas on the subject. But it may be added that the first nation which does practice such eugenic methods as Professor Muller advocates will, in a few decades, be enormously superior to all its rivals. And this seems to me yet another reason why we should, as quickly as possible, get by hook or by crook to the one world ideal, because in the context of nationalism, this could become an instrument of extraordinary power and extraordinary danger, I would say. We come to purely psychological processes. Psychology is quite obviously still in its infancy, and I think we can foresee very remarkable developments within the field. I think, for example, it may become possible within a few decades, perhaps of two or three generations, to understand, for example, the processes of creative thinking, to find out how these processes can be systematized, how they can be taught, how human beings can be educated so as to live to the height of their potential instead of to live only at a small part of capacity. I think these purely psychological processes, added to the various psychopharmacological processes, will probably greatly improve the performance of human beings. And if these are conjoined with eugenic procedures, then we can, I think, with considerable confidence, foresee a remarkable improvement in the human creature. It will cease to be untrue what Emerson said long ago: all men plume themselves on the improvement of society, but no man improves. It may be possible now to get men to improve, and therefore to improve society, but who knows whether this will be accomplished or not. But I think we are perfectly justified in saying that it can be accomplished now. Well, then, very briefly, let's talk about mechanical advances. Well, I don't think I have to talk much about this because this is so constantly spoken about. But I would think that probably the most important mechanical advances will be connected with the great electronic computing machines, which will enable us to perform feats of thinking, problem solvings on scales which we were never capable of before, and which will therefore open up rational action in a way which was quite impossible in the past. I mean, it may be possible even to conceive of a rational policy taking place, of knowing what all the possibilities in a field are and of choosing the best, which has really been left entirely to the intuition of politicians in the past, and which now maybe come under the control of, thanks to these extraordinary machines, of fact and of reason based upon fact. I was reading just the other day in a recent number of Harper's Magazine a fascinating new electronic device which is used for doing research in the literature of science, in the back numbers of scientific periodicals, which is an appalling job at present. I mean, when one thinks that, I don't know, 100,000 papers are published every year, and that there is a backlog of literally millions of papers, and that it's incredibly difficult to discover what in fact has been done in this jungle of material, and that now an electronic machine has been developed into which you can put punched cards, the papers, the subject matter of the papers has to be transferred to, not to punched cards, I suppose, to magnetic tape, and that in a very short time the machine will tell you where to go and where you can find out what you wish to find out. I mean, this is the kind of thing which is now becoming possible, and which I think is going to be of enormous importance in the future. Of course, we mustn't forget our friends, the Sputniks and satellites. These, I think, will be exceedingly useful, not so much in regard to outer space as in regard to the Earth. They will give us extremely good information about weather and so on. And I was appalled to read Dr. von Braun the other day as saying that satellites will be sent up and a number of them will be connected together by radio into a kind of electric relay, which will permit TV programs to be globally transmitted at any moment. So that this, I think, is a grave menace, but there it is. And well, in conclusion, I mean, it seems quite clear that the conclusion is obvious that enormous possibilities lie open to us, that we are on the threshold of profound discoveries within our own nature, within external nature, and so on, that if we can solve these basic political and demographic problems, that we could create a world of most incalculably superior nature. Whether we shall do so or not, I don't know, but I think it is very important to realize that this does lie within our possibilities, and the immediate future is probably immensely important in regard to these possibilities, that it is within the immediate future that we shall have to make the basic decision whether we use these possibilities or not. Harrison Brown has summed it up by saying that the next 100 years will undoubtedly prove to be more critical than any that mankind as a whole has yet been called upon to face. This is a very sobering prospect, because, and I think it's perfectly true that it is up to us to decide whether we shall realize these immense potentialities for good, or whether we shall use these immense potentialities in completely inhuman and abominable ways. More than 50 years ago, Tolstoy said that in a society which is badly organized, as ours is, where a small minority rules over the majority, every scientific advance, every conquest of nature, strengthens the hand of the minority against the majority. And this is unfortunately perfectly true, I think. And what we have to decide now is whether these immense conquests of nature and accessions of knowledge which we are gaining are to be used for frightful and inhuman ends, or whether they are to be used to create the kind of progress of which we have dreamed, and indeed kinds of progress of which I don't think anybody has ever dreamed, because these potentialities which are now opening up before us have never been present in the history of the world before. So that, as I say, we undoubtedly in the future face a time of an extraordinarily critical nature. And before I close, I would like to say that next week's lecture will be the last in this series, and that I shall use it for summing up what has been said and giving a slight a preliminary account of what I shall be saying next semester.